This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar. Years ago tomorrow, 16th of March, 2003. At the time, she was undertaking nonviolent direct action to protect the home of a Palestinian family from demolition. After her death, her parents, Cindy and Craig Corey, formed the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice, a nonprofit organization that conducts and supports programs fostering connections between people, building understanding, respect, and appreciation for differences, and promoting cooperation within and between local and global communities. We are joined on the phone now from Olympia by Rachel Corey's mother, Cindy Corey. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jenka, and Craig is on the line as well.
Hi, Jenka.
Thank you. So Cindy and Craig Corey, the parents of the late Rachel Corey, and I wonder if you could start by talking about what you're planning for tomorrow, the 10th anniversary of your daughter's death.
We have a big day ahead, starting with a rally at 1 p.m. at Sylvester Park in downtown Olympia. It's a well-known gathering place for people in our community. The rally is themed Stand for Justice, Freedom for Palestinians, and Accountability for U.S. Foreign Military Funding. And we have a lineup of speakers of Palestinians that will be, speaking to their desires for freedom and for all their people, and also those who have stood in solidarity with them. And then we move, and I think people may be happy that we'll be moving to the Olympia Ballroom. I think we're going to have a little rain tomorrow, but we'll take things indoors. And we're thrilled that Ramzi Baroud, of the Palestine Chronicle, author, journalist, and from Gaza, will be with us, and also Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Both will be with us for a discussion of these past 10 years. Rachel Corey and Freedom for Palestine, where have we been these past 10 years and where are we headed? That'll be moderated by Dr. Steve Naiva from the Evergreen State College, and there will be time for all of them to have some discussion amongst themselves, and then also for Q&A from the audience. And we have friends in the community who are planning to have wonderful displays in the ballroom. I hope it'll be a space that's inviting for people to come. We have such imaginative people here creating it. And we'll have music. David Rovix, who wrote the intro song that you provided, will be with us. Batiste Debka Dance Troupe, the House of Terub, which is a wonderful music group from the Seattle area, will be joining us. We have a set aside a time for remembrances where you'll hear from a lot of people in a very short time about how Rachel's story about her stand in Gaza, how that's impacted and inspired folks. And we have a community potluck, something that's a tradition here between 5 and 7 p.m. We have for years now gathered people in our community, and this year we know there are people coming from the Portland area, from the Seattle area, and even beyond to join us. We're so excited about that, and we'll just share a good time remembering and thinking about the work that lies ahead of us all.
And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about Rachel and her life. She was a student at Evergreen, and you mentioned the creativity in Olympia. It seems like Rachel was very much a part of that.
Go ahead, Craig.
Oh, yeah, usually Cindy talks more about Rachel, but she just got done with a talking. But, yeah, Rachel was a member of our community here. She was the youngest of our three children, and so she actually was born in Olympia and lived here all of her life, and so through all of her school, including college at the Evergreen State College. I think she was the youngest of our children. Like I said, she was a kid that was in the corner, sort of observing our family. She would be drawing or playing with play mobile when she was little or so, or writing. We'd find scraps of paper from a pretty young age, either with drawings or maybe little poems and things on them. And she had a sense of humor in reflecting back some of the things that she saw in our family. I'm thinking right now of a time when the Olympia School District, I think, called Cindy, and they were just taking a survey, and they wanted to know what sort of value should be taught in the Olympia School District. And I think Rachel was not yet in school, but she was watching her older brother and sister yell out these things that I don't know, appreciation for ice cream or something that they wanted their mother to answer, and she just sort of stood back, as I think as I remember it, about a 4-year-old, and quietly said, "Manners." They should teach manners. And so, you know, that sense of humor as a little child. She enjoyed the outdoors. We live, I'm looking right now at a tidal flat, the Perry Creek that we live along. And she described herself as growing up in Perry Creek. And she'd say her house was through the woods and up the hill, but she grew up and she lived in Perry Creek. And there was some truth to that. She would be down there observing the tidal flats, playing in the grasses when the tide was out, and in the stream, and sometimes swimming in the high tide and stuff when it's in, or canoeing. And all of her kids did some of that, but I think she observed it. Or at least she was the writer, so we know that she observed it because she wrote about that. And, of course, she went to high school here. She had things to say about that in her journals and that are in her play that I won't repeat on the radio. But anyway, like a lot of high schoolers, she was conflicted a little bit about that. But anyway, I went on to Evergreen. And throughout that, I think one of the remarkable things, particularly if you look at Rachel's writing, is that I would describe kind of a constant through all that, is that more than anybody else I think I know, she refused to look away from marginalized people. She wrote a poem when she was 12 years old about the homeless in Olympia. And you know, I'm her father, so of course I think it's good. But I thought it was kind of spot on in terms of our wanting them to, you know, hand them money so we didn't really have to see them, didn't really have to hear them. It's much easier to love somebody from afar. But she didn't allow herself to do that. And so she got to know people, I think, that may be marginalized in our society better than at least her father. And she worked with people that had mental illness issues, and she got a great deal of, I think, strength from those people and insight into herself. And at least one of the people that she worked with there has become a friend of ours, and I understand what she loved in him. And then, of course, it's hard to find somebody, I think, in a way, certainly 10 years ago, that was more marginalized, and I think still true today, more marginalized than the people of Gaza. And so if you look at it that way, I think it seems like a sort of a natural progression through her life of just refusing to turn away. Mm.
I think one of the most compelling scenes in the film Occupation 101 is an archive clip of Rachel, I think she was 11, and saying the children in other countries that are starving and dying of hunger, they're just like us, they are us, this compelling little voice that she seemed to always be connected to the marginalized elements of society.
She had studied world hunger. That, the origins of that video are that her class, her fifth grade class, was studying world hunger. And they were here in the state capital in Olympia, and with the leadership of wonderful teachers that Rachel was blessed with, the class went and did a press conference on that. It was, I think, too, it was the International Day of the Child or the International Year of the Child, and they felt that they could make a difference. And Rachel wrote her speech, and then she delivered her speech at the Capitol, and it actually got picked up, pieces of it, by Seattle TV stations, so that the the goal that the kids had of trying to bring attention to what was happening in children in other places was really achieved. Craig and I had forgotten that that video existed, and then when Rachel was killed, some of our friends reminded us, brought it to us, and I remember some of the first questions after Rachel was killed from journalists were, was she always an activist? And I said, no, she was just our kid. But then I saw that video and I thought, well, there was always that kernel in Rachel from a very young age.
Wow. And again, we're speaking with the parents of the late Rachel Corrie, who was killed 10 years ago tomorrow in Gaza. Her parents, Craig and Cindy Corrie, speaking to us from Olympia, Washington, where they have a number of events planned for tomorrow to mark the 10th anniversary of Rachel's death. And Rachel Corrie has become a symbol of nonviolent activism for the Palestinian people in much the same way that Ben Linder, a name that might be familiar to Portlanders, became in the 1980s for the people of Nicaragua when he went there as part of the Sandinista uprising, and Amy Beale in South Africa, who was killed just before the end of apartheid there. And I understand that in the formation of your foundation, you met with the parents of Amy Beale, and I wonder if you can talk about those connections. How do you feel the situation of the Palestinians is related to the South African model of apartheid?
Well, yeah, we did meet with Linda Beale. Amy's father passed away before Rachel was killed, so we didn't meet, but with him. But Linda Beale was giving a speech talk up in at the UW, the University of Washington, a little bit, I think it was about 2 weeks after Rachel was killed, and some people that we didn't know at the time but have since become friends invited us to come up and hear her and meet her. And unfortunately, we didn't really get the email that said, and also speak there. But at any rate, we did come up and spoke a little bit, but listened to her, and which was quite helpful in a lot of ways. I remember feeling that because, it was so new to us, and it seemed like we were walking on a path that had very few footprints ahead of us in the dust. But we did catch up with Linda Beale and somebody that made those footprints, and so she was helpful. She gave us some advice. She's I think the example, though, that she gave us is probably the most important thing. And I didn't see it, but Cindy has seen it. Her daughter was killed by these four Black South Africans, and she has since testified down there in the Truth and Reconciliation, at least for two of those people. I think that you have to opt into that, and I'm not sure what happened to the other two. But two of those people, Linda testified on their behalf, and then when she started a foundation, those two men were hired by that foundation, and Cindy seen her on TV, actually on a stage with one of the people that killed her daughter. And I think that's an amazing testimony to sort of her strength and understanding. And I remember asking her, or somebody here anyway, hearing her reply, "Could you ever forgive?" Forgive him for killing your daughter? And she said, no, it wasn't all right, but she had come to understand what in his life had led him to the position that he might do something like that. And so anyway, she's been an extraordinary example to us and inspiration, and perhaps where that first idea of starting a foundation came from as well.
One thing I remember from the conversation with Linda was that I asked her, and this was 2 weeks after Rachel was killed, whether she, after having this happen to her daughter, was ever able to reclaim her previous life before that time. And she stopped and didn't respond immediately. She thought for a moment, and then she looked at me and she said, not really. And my daughter Sarah was with us at the time, and she said she knew, hearing that exchange, that it was kind of, she said, game over as far as what had come before, that our lives had changed so irrevocably, and that with inspiration from people like Linda Beale, things were going to take a different direction for us as well, and they have. I think in response to your question about the apartheid comparison, I know that some people find that problematic, difficult to hear, but I think there are even Israeli officials now in government who have acknowledged that what is happening either is apartheid or is on the brink of apartheid. And Desmond Tutu in South Africa said that what he was seeing, what was happening in Palestine, was worse than what happened during apartheid South Africa. What Craig and I have experienced, of course, is being in Israel for an extended amount of time for the civil trial in Rachel's case, and coming to know both Israeli Jews and Israeli Palestinians who tell us that there are distinctions made between the Palestinian citizens of Israel and the Jewish citizens of Israel. They don't enjoy equal rights. And so that is a definition of apartheid. And that doesn't even take into account the West Bank and Gaza, which are separated by from the Jewish population of Israel, from the Palestinian population of Israel, with walls, with checkpoints, with fences, and Israel has a responsibility for those people that are living under this extended occupation. So I think that most people looking at this carefully say that the analogy is very apt, sadly, and it's something that has to be challenged.
In fact, there's a movie put out recently called Roadmap to Apartheid by an Israeli activist and a South African activist. Roadmap to Apartheid makes that comparison and talks with a number of South African anti-apartheid activists as well as Israelis and Palestinians. And I want to, you mentioned the civil trial, and I want to just ask about that. After your daughter was killed, an American killed abroad, you would think the American government would be concerned and want to take action. But 10 years later, there still has not been justice in the case. And I wonder if you can talk about, particularly last August, the ruling in that case against the Israeli government.
Yeah, and I'll go back if I can for just a minute, although probably most KBOO listeners know the history, but remind people that actually the day after Rachel was killed, President Bush had a conversation with Prime Minister Sharon and was promised by Sharon a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation in Rachel's killing with a report to be given to the U.S. government. But it is the U.S. government's opinion that never happened. And they've been on record in writing to our family, first in June of 2004, so a little more than a year after Rachel's killing. But it's been reiterated under oath in Congress by members of the State Department, and most recently in August when we went back to Israel, and the U.S. ambassador, Daniel Shapiro, to Israel, reiterated that that's still the opinion of the U.S. government. So you're right. We always thought that there ought to be an investigation into what happened to Rachel. There ought to be complete explanation, and it ought to be something so that others, unbiased people, could look at the facts that were uncovered, they could look at the conclusions that were made from those facts, and they could follow the reasoning through so that they could arrive at those same conclusions. You know, so don't base it on what Rachel's father thinks is reasonable, but try to base it on what an outside person would think. But even our government says that hasn't happened. They have declined. We worked for years to try to get our own Justice Department to do an investigation, but eventually they declined to do that and said that there was only one law under which you could bring any sort of, you know, in which it was a crime to kill a U.S. a citizen abroad. And that may seem strange, but in actuality, you know, our laws aren't you know, U.S. law really doesn't impact or is supposed to have control over, I don't know, Brazil or Israel or China or whatever. You know, they have their own laws for that. So it makes a little bit of sense. But there was a law, but our Justice Department said that they didn't think it was the intent of Congress to apply it in a case like this. And they also said that their decision was made partly on a policy basis rather than on a legal basis. And so that was disturbing. And actually that law, it says that that it's illegal to to kill or harm a individual. Cindy, do you know what I'm trying to quote here?
To coerce or intimidate a civilian population or government.
Yeah, and so I guess looking at the situation that was going on in Gaza, that, you know, Rachel was certainly killed as part of an attempt to intimidate the civilian population there, and I think the government in that area as well. But it was the conclusion of our Justice Department that was not the intent of Congress. And also, it can only be used if the Attorney General signs on that in his belief that those things were met. It really doesn't have to do, there's no way to argue either that what I just did, that it's pretty clear that it was an attempt to intimidate or retaliate, et cetera. You can only look at the document and say, yep, that's the signature of the Attorney General. And so the first time we talked to somebody in justice is actually the U.S. attorney from Western Washington. And he said, in his words, he said, there will never be an attorney general, past, present, or future, that will ever sign such a document in the case of Israel. So he's actually pretty straight up with us from the beginning. But you're right. The only process that we control is to have a civil trial, you know, and bring forward something civil. And so we did that in Israel, and we did eventually end up in court. And over, I think we ended up living in Haifa, Israel, where the court was, for a total of about 9 months as this trial dragged on, about 15 hearing days and 22 witnesses. In the end, on August 28th of last year, the judge finally ruled that essentially dismissed the case after everything was heard, because he said that that Rachel's killing was part of an act of war, and as an act of war, it could not be criticized by the state of Israel, could not be held liable for what they do as an act of war, which of course flies in the face of all sorts of international laws and rules, and our family is appealing that verdict to the Israeli High Court.
And are you pursuing anything at the international level?
We are not at this point. Our understanding, and we really haven't looked at that carefully, but our understanding is that before something could be dealt with at an international court level, we would have to exhaust all other possibilities in the country where Rachel was killed, and here in the United States, I think, too. And, you know, I think we're close to doing that, but it's still going to take some time before we could ever consider, I think, a move to the international courts.
Mm. And this is the case of an American civilian who was killed in Gaza. That same year, in fact, just a couple of months after Rachel was killed in 2003, another activist, Tom Herndahl, was also shot and killed in the same area. And what's the difference in the response of the British government to his killing and to the Israeli government's ruling in his case?
It was actually less time than you mentioned. Within 7 weeks, in a seven-week period, three internationals were killed in the southern Gaza Strip within a two-mile stretch of each other. Rachel, this was all along the Philadelphia corridor. Rachel was the first. Tom Herndahl was the second. And then the photo journalist, James Miller. He was creating an HBO documentary on home demolitions, and he was also killed. James and Tom were both from the UK. The UK certainly, their situations were each slightly different. I will say Tom was not immediately killed. He never regained consciousness, but he'd lost a quarter of his brain, but he miraculously was still alive, and he survived until, I believe it was January of the following year. His family, because of that, spent a lot of time in Israel. His father was an attorney. They were people who couldn't believe that something like this would be intentional. They went looking for evidence. There were 13 or more eyewitnesses, I believe, to what happened. And Anthony Herndl went and gathered all of that testimony while he was there in Israel. And then they went back to the UK he became convinced that, in fact, this was intentional. There was so much clear lying associated with what the Israeli government was saying had happened to Tom. And eventually, there was a verdict in that case. A soldier did go to jail for some years, but has been released subsequently. But the difference, I think, between the two governments is instructive. There was much more pressure put, I think, on Israel by the British government, by their Jack Straw at the time, who was like the equivalent of our Secretary of State. There were members of Parliament who actually went to Gaza, and people that were that within their government that really took this on in a big way. But they also did, within their system, they have inquiries in their coroner's inquiries. And a decision was made to combine the two inquiries into James's killing and Tom's killing. So within the British government, there are these inquiries when they have citizens killed outside their country.
Wow! So a really different response from the British government to the American government's response to Rachel Corrie's killing. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have. And I want to thank you both so much for joining us. I've been speaking with Craig and Cindy Corrie. Their daughter, Rachel Corrie, was killed 10 years ago tomorrow in Gaza when she stood in front of an Israeli bulldozer to try to stop the demolition of a Palestinian home and was crushed to death by that bulldozer. Tomorrow there are a number of events both in Olympia and around the country. You can find more information at rachelcorriefoundation.org. Thank you, Craig and Cindy Corrie, so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. We hope to see people in Olympia.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO Radio.
When you went back across the green line, back to the open shore, was this just another day in a dirty war? When you looked out on the water, did you feel an empty? Was it just one more life you've taken, one more home destroyed, one more home destroyed?
This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM. Coming up on the Incomparable Radio Zine, Sarah Sneath visits the Bhakti Shop, a local yoga studio, where she learns about the ancient practice of kirtan, a call-and-response chanting. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to KBOO.FM and click on Donate Today.
Namah Hari Om Shanti. The singing you're hearing is that of Lisa May Osborne, the owner of the Bhakti Shop. The second Sunday of every month, her and the rest of Mala, the Bhakti Shop house band, lead a call and response chanting of Hindu divinities. The ritual, known as kirtan, originates from India, but has grown in popularity in the United States, along with the practice of yoga. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Sarah Sneath, and for the next half hour, I'll be exploring the practice of kirtan, how it became popular in the United States, and what it means to those who practice it. In 1969, George Harrison's recording of Hare Krishna Mantra made the British music charts. The Hare Krishna movement hit critical mass in the 60s and 70s.
I started chanting back in the 1960s when I heard the Hare Krishna Mantra as chanted by, I think it's called the Bhakti Vandanta movement with Swami Prabhupada. You heard it mostly either in the streets, like in San Francisco or Boston, or at the airports. There are a lot of young people chanting and playing drums and having a good time.
Robert Zorn, heard here, has continued his practice of kirtan for more than 40 years, and now leads kirtan at the Yogashala of Portland every first Friday. What is kirtan?
Well, kirtan literally means to repeat, and for me, kirtan is like Indian folk music. It's a call and response where people can join in if you choose to, as opposed to raga singing where you listen to someone go up and down scales, chanting.